Quality News. This is the Quality News Network. In a joint statement read by President Bush, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas agreed to start discussions on the key subjects of the Mideast conflict. Today's peace summit in Annapolis, Maryland is the first peace talk in 7 years. In the past 48 hours, Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 7 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israelis say the men all belong to Hamas. In Hebron, in the West Bank, a protest against the Annapolis peace talk prompted clashes between those loyal to Palestinian President Abbas and Islamists who call him a traitor. One demonstrator was shot and killed during the skirmishes. Stocks bounced back today on news that Citigroup got a cash infusion of $7 billion from the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority. The Dow was up over 200 points today. We'll have the numbers coming up in our business segment. Well, this holiday season may be bleak for many Americans who will lose their homes due to foreclosure. An estimated 1.4 million U.S. families will be forced into foreclosure. According to the consulting firm Global Insight, escalated failed mortgage payments will knock approximately $676 billion from home values. Rising home foreclosures and gas prices drove consumer confidence down to the lowest level since Hurricane Katrina in 2005. The Consumer Confidence Index fell to 87.3. Economists had predicted the number for November would be 90.2. The defense ministries of South and North Korea hold a landmark meeting today to discuss resolution of a long-standing border dispute in the West Sea. In Pakistan, President General Pervez Musharraf said farewell to troops today. He is expected to officially resign tomorrow as head of the country's army. Thursday, Musharraf will be sworn in for a new term as Pakistan's president. The U.S. military says it has killed 6 unarmed Iraqi civilians in the past 48 hours. Included were 2 women and a child. Troops opened fire on vehicles that did not appear to slow down when waved over by authorities. 4 civilians were wounded in those shootings. A suicide bomber disguised as a shepherd blew himself up near a group of Baghdad policemen today, killing 9. And the inventor of Gatorade has passed away. Robert Cade's death was announced by officials at the University of Florida, where Cade invented the drink for the Gators football team.
Civility takes an effort. It requires that people remember that relationships need our attention. Whether we are talking about our most important personal relationships, how we get along with our colleagues, or the way we interact with strangers, it is what we contribute that defines the results. Even when the other people are not prepared to give their best selves, what we put in determines what we get out. Ralph Waldo Emerson suggested, "We must be as courteous to a man as we are to a picture, which we are willing to give the advantage of a good light." This is the essence of civility. When we are civil to strangers, when we defer at the intersection instead of racing out ahead, when we hold the door for someone we don't know, when we smile at someone who catches our eye, we declare our choice for a civilized society. For more information, click on the Civility button on our website, QualityNewsNetwork.com.
The president of the American Red Cross was let go today after it was determined he engaged in a personal relationship with a subordinate employee. Mark Everson was appointed to the position last May. The Food and Drug Administration is reviewing the flu drug Tamiflu. The drug is under scrutiny following reports of odd behavior in patients, especially children. FDA staffers recommend stronger label warnings. Netherlands lighting company Royal Philips Electronics announced it will acquire Louisville, Kentucky fixture manufacturer Genlight. Royal Philips will pay $2.7 billion. Funding has been obtained to start construction on an undersea cable linking Europe to East Africa. The revolutionary project will provide reliable and relatively inexpensive telecommunications in East Africa for the first time. And gold is trading down, or rather up, $12.50 at $814 an ounce. Light sweet crude oil is trading at $94.42 a barrel. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones ended up 215 points. The NASDAQ was up 40 points, and the S&P 500 is up 21 points. We have more news on our website at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Claudia Eisman.
Hey. And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I hope everyone had a pleasant Thanksgiving. I sure did. I was home with family in my hometown in Nashville, Tennessee. Had a terrific time. But, of course, since I've been gone, the news stacks up, and that's why I have the Week in Review today to cover all kinds of issues, large and small, that have been missed, I think, at least by me during last week, because I was gone. And if you have a comment on any of these, you're always welcome to call in. What's on the agenda today? Well, there's a heavy agenda. I want to talk about election 2008. First of all, the presidential race, religion and politics. Is it fair that Mitt Romney is being punished by Republican voters for being Mormon? How should a progressive think about that? How should we think about Oprah Winfrey, who is out there before the Iowa caucuses and is pulling for her man Barack Obama? Is that kind of celebrity endorsement fair? Also talking about the congressional races in 2008. Yes, it's not too early to think about those. It looks to me like Senate's going to be quite a romp for the Democrats with the retirement of Trent Lott. I think it's likely we're going to do very, very well there, and a lot of these days Republican filibusters will be harder and harder to do. I think it's likely we'll win seats in the House, too, something which seemed unthinkable just a year ago, though certainly our prospects are better in the Senate. What does it have to do with all of us pushing the Democrats to the left? Does that help us or hurt us for election 2008? Also abroad, there are elections. Russia is cracking down. No one seems to be able to stop Vladimir Putin or to want to. George Bush is busy with other things. So is Europe. And meanwhile, that last great evil empire, remember them? Prior to 9/11, the former Soviet Union is now coming back in spades as Putin consolidates power and puts activists like former chess champion Garry Kasparov in jail. Bad news in Russia, but good news in Australia, as it is shown how a center-left party, the Labour Party in Australia, can cruise to victory, believe it or not, on union rights, on workers' rights, on the kind of rights that are increasingly being denied in America and barely ever talked about. No, we're mostly focused on things like illegal aliens, that great bugaboo of Republicans. And I want to focus on that, too, not just the driver's license controversy that's popped up in New York and in the presidential campaign, but on something even more controversial, an argument for giving health care to illegal aliens, not based on compassion. We know that that's not an argument likely to win the hearts and minds of the Republicans or even the middle of the country, but based on pure economics. Elsewhere in the Middle East, we have Pakistan, the General Musharraf, becoming Prime Minister Musharraf, but basically becoming Dictator Musharraf. And the interesting thing there is the parallels between exactly what's going on in Pakistan today and what happened with the Shah of Iran 25, now almost 30 years ago. And I'm afraid that the post-Shah Iran may end up with a post-Musharraf Pakistan if we don't act quickly. What else is in the news? There's two other big stories in the news that I'm going to devote tomorrow and the next day too, so I won't talk too much about today. One is the Supreme Court's decision for the first time in about 70 years to ask the question of whether the Second Amendment to the Constitution protects an individual's right to own a gun. The District of Columbia passed a law to ban most handguns, and for the first time in American history, it is possible the United States Supreme Court will hold that owning a gun is an individual right. They've never held that before. I'm devoting all of tomorrow to a discussion of gun laws and the Constitution and the Second Amendment. So it'll be a bit of history, a bit of law, and a lot of discussion of gun rights. That's tomorrow. And then Thursday, we're going to talk about Annapolis. I know that's all in the news. I certainly devote a lot of time to talking about Israel and the Palestinians, and we'll give the ins and outs, the players, who's to gain, who's to lose, what's likely to happen, what's likely not to happen, and why it's all happening today, and that'll be Annapolis on Thursday. So we'll leave gun rights and Second Amendment in Annapolis till tomorrow and Thursday. I want to talk about all these other topics I raised today. What else is in the news? Well, somehow, some people are surprised, but no one here at the Horn, that Dick Cheney has a defective heart. Well, that shouldn't surprise anyone. Dick Cheney having a defective heart, I mean, that's kind of redundant, isn't it? And let's just start off, before we get into the re-details of all that I've discussed, I want to talk a little bit about Sarah Taylor. Do you remember Sarah Taylor? You probably don't. You may. She was a young woman, a somewhat attractive woman, who testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Remember, she was one of the small players that happened to be firing our U.S. prosecutors, something that Attorney General Gonzalez insisted he didn't do, and the Deputy Attorney General said he didn't do, and the Chief of Staff said they didn't do, and Bush said he didn't do, and Karl Rove isn't speaking. But Sarah Taylor, one of those that apparently, without being asked, managed to fire all these prosecutors who were involved in doing things like putting criminal Republicans behind bars or failing to prosecute Democrats who hadn't done anything wrong. You may recall that she was the one who told the Senate Judiciary Chairman, Patrick Leahy, quote, "I need to respect and do respect my service to the president." To which Patrick Leahy responded, no, quote, You take an oath to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States," unquote. Well, Sarah Taylor apparently had it confused. She thought that she had a personal loyalty to the president, much as some had loyalty to dictators in other countries. But she's being rewarded. She is leaving the government to become a partner at the Blue Front Group that works for the Consumer Alliance for Energy Security. So as long as oil prices go up, as long as we get cheap crude oil from Iraq and Saudi Arabia, as long as those policies continue, Sarah Taylor will become an extremely rich woman. And that's about as surprising as the fact that Dick Cheney has a defective heart. But let's talk about the Middle East. Many of you heard the story that Bob Kincaid talked about yesterday. The woman in Saudi Arabia who is going to be lashed 200 times with a whip for being raped. You see, in Saudi Arabia, it's a crime for a woman to be with any man that is not her relative or her husband. And this woman apparently went to an old boyfriend to get some pictures back. We don't know what those pictures were, because she was going to be married to a new man. To a fiance, her fiancé, and presumably wanted to protect the sanctity of their new marriage. In any case, both she and her ex-boyfriend were raped, and both she and he were punished. Now, the rapists were punished too. But she and he were sentenced to 90 lashes. Her lawyer had the audacity to appeal that ruling, and therefore the judge got mad at the lawyer. And to punish the lawyer for appealing the ruling, he's going to sentence the woman to 200 lashes. The attorney himself may lose his license for daring to tell the Western press about what's going on in Saudi Arabia. But you see, we need Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is our ally. Saudi Arabia is the one that we Americans fought and died for in the Persian Gulf War. We need them to come to Annapolis. We need their blessing on any Israeli-Palestinian peace treaty. So we're going to look the other way. We're not going to talk about it. The same government that ruthlessly condemned the Taliban, and rightly so, in Afghanistan for the head-to-foot coverings in black, for their minimal recognition of women's rights, fails to say anything about women's rights in what is now the most sexist, regressive country on earth towards women, Saudi Arabia. In fact, I know Bob's got a story today, which he has all the details of, where a classroom teacher allowed her young children to call a teddy bear Muhammad. She will get 200 lashes as well. Meanwhile, in the Middle East, Pakistan is becoming, well, very much like what pre-Khomeini Iran was. The Shah of Iran, it's fair to say, did some good things in Iran. He did some terrible stuff, too. He tortured his own people, and we indeed, our CIA taught his secret police called the SAVAK how to torture people, and we of course helped overthrow the democratically elected leader prior to the Shah. A guy by the name of Mossadegh was dethroned by President Eisenhower in the 50s. And the Shah did many good things. He modernized his country. He secularized it. He took it away from religious oppression. He gave women full rights. And indeed, the Shah could have been a decent transition character if he had, after modernizing and secularizing his country, after promoting the middle class, after he had gone by the wayside and promoted democracy. He did not. Instead, he did his best to stay in power by any means necessary, and thus took a country that was one of the most modern in the Middle East, one of the most secular in the Middle East, and created the dangerous religious theocracy dictatorship that we have today. Well, guess what? Musharraf is walking that same plank. Pakistan is not a backward country. It is not like Afghanistan or even like Saudi Arabia. It has a decent middle class. You may recall that the people who are fighting Musharraf are largely lawyers dressed up in suits. When have you ever seen lawyers take against riot police? They have this middle class. They even have a bit of a democratic tradition, nothing like India, which has been a democracy for 60 years, but they have had free elections. They have had a free press. And Musharraf, much like the Shah of Iran, seems destined to throw it all away. The interesting thing is that the opponents of Musharraf are primarily this middle class. Now, there also is Al-Qaeda, and I understand that the Bush administration wants to help Pakistan to fight Al-Qaeda. But you know where Musharraf is putting his troops? I'll give you a hint. It's not on the border with Afghanistan. It's not policing the areas where Osama bin Laden lives. No, he's letting the Islamists run full rein, probably because he wants to use their threat to help maintain his power. Instead, he's focusing his troops on the lawyers, on the middle class, on the decent people that are fighting for democracy. And as usual, our government says nothing. Much as we're saying nothing with regard to Russia and Vladimir Putin, and I'll get to that subject after the break. If you want to call in and discuss any of these topics, or you have your own, please join me on the Week in Review. The toll-free number is 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2666. Right after this.
You're listening to the Head-On Radio Network.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
This is the Head-On Radio Network, The Horn.
Yeah, my name is
Tune in to Foxed Up with John Fox this Thursday night at his new time, midnight Eastern. We'll take a look at England's bad girl, Amy Winehouse.
I'm someone who can't keep my mouth shut. I will just say what's on my mind, and they will put me in the paper for that. They will say, oh, and she's bitter and twisted about stuff.
So be there, Thursday night, midnight Eastern, right here on the Head-On Radio Network, The Horn.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Every 3 minutes, another woman gets the news that she has breast cancer. And here are some of the first words she hears. HER2-NU oncogene, aromatase inhibitor, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How are you going to decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? Please listen to me, Marvin Hamlisch. As soon as you get your diagnosis, go to breastcancer.org. It's a special place on the internet where you can learn how to say all those breast cancer words and find out what they mean. At breastcancer.org, you can learn more about your particular kind of cancer and your treatment options. Prepare a list of questions for your next doctor's visit and get all kinds of other useful information to guide you and your family through this. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. It's the Week in Review. Got a long list of things happening this week. Most of the United States is focused on the Iowa caucuses, which, believe it or not, are just around the corner, with the states leapfrogging everyone to earlier and earlier times. It looks like it's just right at the spanking new year we're going to have the Iowa caucuses, which is about a month from now. And then probably the candidates will be chosen in March, and then we'll have to wait 7 months before the November elections. It's a ridiculous system. It's one that needs to be changed. And frankly, why are the voters of Iowa and New Hampshire so special? I mean, I'm sorry to those of you who live in Des Moines or Manchester, but folks, I like you very much. But who made you kingmaker? Huh? What about the rest of us? I understand the need to start with small states. I'm willing to say that it should always be a small state. But if Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina get first dibs this go-around, then, you know, next go-around, it should be, let's say, Connecticut and one of the Dakotas and, let's say, New Mexico and, what's a good small southern state? Alabama. Whatever it is, we need to mix it up. It's only fair. In any case, it is around the corner, and everyone's talking about election 2008. Before we get to American elections, I want to talk a little bit about foreign elections. Because what is the foreign entity that is most dangerous to America that is least in the press? I mean, Iran, the president talks about every other day. Iraq, everyone talks about. Pakistan has been in the press a lot lately, and it is an important thing to discuss. Even North Korea is there a bunch. But what is, after the United States, the greatest nuclear power on Earth? What is the country with the, after the United States, with the easiest way to cause massive world destruction? It is, of course, Russia, which has the nuclear arsenal of the former Soviet Union. Now, we worked, meaning the United States and NATO and European allies, worked for 50-plus years in the Cold War, losing trillions of dollars, building an entire nuclear arsenal that was redundant three times over in the air and on the sea and on the land, and ICBMs and nuclear subs, and spent trillions of dollars that, heck, if we, you know, had been like Japan without a military, we could have spent with technology and getting rich and health care. And, okay, we, quote, won, unquote, the Cold War. But for all the danger that Al-Qaeda poses, and I don't in any way dispute the danger of Al-Qaeda, and for all the extra danger that they could pose if they got one dirty bomb, or even if Iran were to get nuclear weapons, they don't have 1/1000th of the arsenal of Russia. And yet, as Vladimir Putin slips his country ever so quietly back into dictatorship, we do nothing. Now, I'm not saying we should invade Soviet Union or Russia. That would be as stupid as invading Iran. Actually, it would be more stupid. But we have still some, after George Bush, some recognition in Russia as being proponents of democracy. And we need to make very clear that this is not where we stand. We need to encourage Europe to make the same thing clear. Europe tried to put observers in the Russia's parliamentary elections, which are coming up, by the way, this December 2nd. They're around the corner. They're happening, let's see, I think that's this Sunday. And they wouldn't give the observers visas. They wouldn't allow the full 430-member contingent, which is actually very small when you think about what a large country Russia is. They limited it to 70, and they wouldn't even give visas to them. So the Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights in Europe said, we're not showing up. If you won't have a fair election, we're not going to give you our imprimatur by claiming to observe a fair election. And Putin's response was that jackals trained by Western specialists are the ones organizing protests in the streets. Actually, it's not jackals, unless you think that a grand chess master, Garry Kasparov, is such a jackal. He has largely used his fame as the world chess leader to lead these protests, and he has been sentenced to jail. Well, I guess it's just 5 days in jail. We'll see if it continues. But the point is that Putin is cutting back. There were monitors in the 2003 elections, and there was an even freer election when Yeltsin was in power. And is this is happening very slowly, very inexorably. Could it be that we're going to throw away the trillions of dollars lost, the tens of thousands of lives lost in the Cold War, because we're focused on what? Oil in Iraq? Watch this, folks. Don't let what Putin's doing go unnoticed, even though the mainstream press doesn't seem to have noticed it. Because for all Iran and Pakistan and Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda and North Korea put together, don't pose the threat that a dictatorship, a new Russian dictatorship, poses. And we still have time. There are still those who are marching for democracy in Russia. There is still time to save this country, but it's going to take a kind of active diplomacy that we haven't seen by this president. Another election, one in Australia, gives a lot more hope for us, and I'll get to that in a minute, but first I got to go to my callers. Eric in Vermont, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
Well, I'm not bad for an old guy, you know, hanging in there. Got a daytime job. I'm doing all right. Dire story.
Well, that's all good. What's on your mind?
I got a good government job, and unless I have a problem with pickles, and we won't have a problem.
Well, so what's on your mind today?
You were talking earlier, and that Putin thing was on my radar 3 or 4 years ago, but I was talking in my mind about some of the reflections that I had concerning the anointment of any candidate so early on in the electoral process that we have prior to November 5th, I think it is this year. Am I correct?
In the Democratic nomination, the press has anointed the winner. Yes, Hillary Clinton, a vote has not been cast, and she's already won the nomination, according to every observer. Now, in the Republican nomination, I think anyone would agree, is very much an open race. You don't see the press anointing Giuliani, but the press is largely doing this based on the polls. And in every poll, national poll, I should say, Hillary Clinton is the runaway leader. Now, she may well lose Iowa. I wouldn't be surprised if Barack Obama, with a little help from Oprah Winfrey, were to win Iowa, or even possibly John Edwards, though I think that's less likely. But she's clearly the runaway front runner and has been named so by virtually everybody. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are, I would like to see, I mean, these guys have been running for president for the last year and a half. You know, I would like to see us go into something where, geez, some crow. I mean, you're walking a thing, and it was a sad, sad thing in my mind. I was playing in a rock and roll band in 1968 when RFK was shot after California. And I look at that as saying, how come way back then, we waited until at least back then that something was going on. Why do we have to anoint somebody so quickly? Why can't we let, and somehow, and at some process, the primaries or the caucuses or, you know, whatever.
I'll tell you why,
Eric. Why can't we let
this
go on?
I'll tell you why. The media believes, rightly or wrongly, and they may be right about this, that the American people are bored by discussion of issues. That if you want to try to compare Hillary Clinton's health care plan with Barack Obama's and John Edwards and Dennis Kucinich, that everyone's going to start yawning. And if you talk about the you know, differences, and they are nuanced differences among primary candidates, much more so than between the main parties, but nuances regarding abortion or Iraq or unions or anything else, that the listener's going to be put to sleep. So they think what interests everybody is the horse race. That we don't really care who the horses are, we just want to know who's winning. And the polls do show that Hillary's ahead in the Democratic nomination. They do show the Republican nomination that while Giuliani is ahead, he has a plurality. He has like 30-something percent, whereas Hillary, you know, is getting close to 50%. And so they're more focused on that, and they're focused on, you know, when Hillary says something about Obama or Obama says something about her or Edwards says something about both of them, because they think it's more entertaining. They think the average American doesn't care about the positions on the issues. And I don't know, Eric. I fear they could be right. Well, I fear that Americans do get bored by issues. What do you think?
Well, I think they do get bored by issues, but it's something they've been programmed very much by the media to be programmed by. I mean, they're looking for the sound bites. I mean, and you brought the term entertainment just, you know, like 25 seconds ago. It is entertainment. Why is our electoral process for our country, for the leadership of our country, and where we are going to go as a people and a great country that we have here, based upon a term that you used? And I'm not attacking you for using that term.
No, I think it's the way the media works.
I'm using that as the media uses that term. They've made the political process an entertainment issue.
Well, they have, and I'll tell you why that happens, Eric. I mean, there was a time, as recently as the 70s and even the 80s, where the news divisions of, and there were only three networks then, ABC, NBC, CBS, were seen as a public service, much as C-SPAN is, where they didn't care about making money. Their job was to tell the news to the American people, and they lost a little bit of money, but that's okay because people watch situation comedies and things like that to pay for them. That's not at all the business today. With the competing cable channels, CNN and the Fox Propaganda Channel and MSNBC, with competition from blogs, talk radio, and the Internet, now they see like, oh, well, people aren't going to come to us just to get the straight skinny on the news. They're going to come to us for entertainment. So we're going to do more human interest stories. You know, are we as fat as we used to be? And do we like cats more than dogs? And who's ahead in the race? And what is Hillary wearing around her neck? And all the things that they think will attract people away from the news. I'll tell you that, and they're trying to make money too. Let's face it, the news divisions today are not about providing news. They're not about informing the American people. They're about making as much money as they can. And they think that they get higher ratings by giving us all this glitz. I mean, you know, it's like the Romans in the Colosseum, right? They did gruesome things, but if the public came out to watch, it was popular, it was all good. The one advantage that we still have, and I got to give credit to one thing, even though I think that the small states need to be changed, it shouldn't always be Iowa and New Hampshire. I do give credit to Iowa and New Hampshire voters in that those are small states. And I think they really are looking at the issues. That's where the debates are. That's where the retail politicking is going. And there, you'll find the races a lot closer. In Iowa, Hillary may not even be ahead. It's kind of a three-way tie between her, Barack Obama, and John Edwards, with it looks like Obama pulling out a little bit. And so if he does an upset in Iowa, which he may well do, that may just upset the apple cart and get people to really look at the issues. So if only for our democratic process, I hope he does beat her in Iowa.
Well, getting back to the influence of the media over projecting over who the front runner is, who this person is, which top three we're going to put up for the American people, rather than looking at the whole field of great Democratic candidates. I go back to a luncheon that was held by the what is that luncheon they hold? Damn it!
The Jefferson Jackson dinner.
Pardon me?
The Jefferson Jackson dinner.
It's a news press conference luncheon with Walter Cronkite going back. I was riding down to Warwick on Rhode Island, whatever.
Okay, and anyway, so what happened?
And anyway, in any event, because of my old age and Alzheimer's and everything else, not really. I was listening to Walter Cronkite back in 1995 or 1996. When I was driving down to Rhode Island, and he was talking about exactly the same thing, that he was very concerned, even at that time, about the idea of news is not because of a civic responsibility to provide information to the people, but it was based very, very much in the way that you have stated it previously, to be a profit, to be a profit margin, to give information to the people, to get all the corporate interest to support that profit margin, because they need to have that profit margin, and rather than to provide that in a way that would provide as a public service, the way C-SPAN still is doing, I hope,
I'll tell you, Eric, you know, I've been in the world of talk radio for 4.5 years now. I started in June 03. And I've seen this behind closed doors with my own eyes. Nothing is clearer of this trend than the world of talk radio. They will tell you. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what kind of public impact it has. The only thing that matters is entertainment. And the only thing that matters to them is money. And the irony of all of this is that they will reject an entertaining host with a lot of public support to put in someone who's backed by a lot of money. And I can give you two examples of that. One is Alan Colmes, who I think is one of the worst talk radio or TV hosts of anywhere. I saw him at a closed-door radio and records convention where there were 399 conservative talk radio hosts and me. And he said that he had three goals as a talk radio host. Number one goal was to please his boss, the Fox News Network, which that's what he called it. I call it the Fox Propaganda Network. Number two goal was to be entertaining. And number three goal, if there's time, and only if goals one and two are also done, is to provide some political context, some political talk. And I can tell you that every single talk radio exec I ever talked to, and I'm not just including those on the right, but those on the left as well, will tell you that their goal is not to provide information, not to educate, but to provide entertainment. And that's why, sorry to say, places like Air America have comedians. They don't have people like me who, you know, worked in Washington and knows exactly how it works for good and for ill in the nation's capital. Or people that are out there with working people like Bob Kincaid. No, they have actors and comedians and people who are doing jokes because they think that that will make people more interested. Now, look, I have no problem with jokes. I think Jon Stewart does a heck of a job, frankly. But he also conveys information. It's not empty humor. I mean, there's nothing wrong with humor. But I can tell you that that is how the world works in talk radio. And the sad thing is that, and I know I'm just sound like I've got burnt milk or whatever here, spilled and burnt milk. But, you know, when I was on the air in San Diego, I was the top-ranked weekend talk show host. And then Air America came along, and because they had money, they bought infomercials, they bought me out, and the ratings dropped in half. And but, hey, you know, the radio station was more into making money than they were into even ratings. So that's just the world we live in today. That's the capitalist world we live in. And here's the real irony, and then I'll try to get off this subject, Eric, which I can go on for days.
Because
the real
irony. I want to get on to something else, actually.
Okay, let me make my point, and I'll let you make one last point. The real irony at the end of the day is that it's not even about ratings. Because for the longest time, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, both very, very liberal cities, have had right-wing talk. Even in San Francisco has more right-wing talk than liberal talk in a population that's 90% liberal and 5% conservative. And the reason they do that is because conservatives put millions, indeed tens and hundreds of millions of dollars into talk radio, and liberals and the Democratic Party do not. And so there, even when you have the majority of the people in a town like San Francisco, the most liberal place in the United States, wanting progressive radio, they don't get it. Because conservatives spend hundreds of millions of dollars on it, and the Democrats don't. Make your last point.
The point I was trying to get to, eventually, was I would like to have an open convention. I would like to have the delegates so split that it gets marginalized. How that gets done, whether or not one candidate or another, whoever that may be, may lock in enough delegates prior to the convention is another story. Do you think there's a reasonable chance that through the dynamics of a lot of the changes that are going on here, might get into that perspective of having an open convention.
There hasn't been an open convention in the United States in about 50 years. Given where we are now, I would say it is virtually impossible for that to happen in the Democratic Party in this particular race. I do think, and I hate to be sounding like the other pundits here, but Hillary Clinton, it's hers to lose. The only possibility, and I give it a small possibility, but give it, say, 10 or 20% possibility of an open convention would be in the Republican race, which is wide open because the Republicans don't like their candidates. And the Democrats, I mean, we're all pretty happy with our candidates. We might want Kucinich over Clinton, but we recognize that she's better than any of the Republicans. The Republicans are actually very angry at their choices, and so I think there's actually more of a chance happening there than the Democratic Party.
My total agreement with the Republicans.
There you go.
Thanks for your call, Eric. Your comment about the Republicans.
No, I understand. I understand wanting an open convention, but at the end of the day, if primary voters choose a candidate, then they have to be respected. And there is definitely, when you have these 9 and 10 candidate races, there's definitely a piling on effect where you vote for people near the front. I mean, I happen to like Chris Dodd a lot, for example. I like a lot of what he stands for, not everything, but I might consider him if he were not running 1% in the polls, way in the back of a pack. As it is, I'm not even thinking about voting for him. I'm not even considering his plans because he's so far in the back. You know, I'll probably cast my vote for Hillary or Barack Obama. I haven't decided yet. But people do tend to vote for the front runners because they feel like, hey, you know, you're not throwing your vote away, and I get that too. One of the things, Eric, I want to thank you for your call very much. This actually leads to a nice segue into the Australian election, which I did want to talk about, because in Australia, they have a more democratic system than ours. And one way they do it, and they still allow third parties to vote, is they have you rank your candidates in order of preference. So in Australia, for example, the Green Party got 7.6% of the vote. That's fine. In our country, you would think the Green Party would hurt the Democrats. And in Australia, the Green Party did not hurt Labor. Why not? Because in Australia, they could put their second choice as Labor. So they could vote for their Green candidates. If the Green candidate won a majority, that Green candidate would win. But when they didn't win a majority, they could vote for Labor as their second choice. And Labor won a tremendous victory in Australia. And I know John Fox is very excited about this. I think I'm going to join him and Bob at 11 o'clock tonight. I really want to ask him some questions about the Australian victory. But here you had a conservative in power for 11 years who's just kicked out. Labor has one of its largest share of the vote in 60 years. And what did they win on? What lessons can we learn in the United States? How did Labor win in Australia? Two things. Well, maybe three things. On the power of youth, on the power of environmentalism, and on the power of worker rights. Now, it almost seems amazing in our country, which is torn by the Republican Party, who's trying to separate us on how much we hate gay people or how much we don't want women to have abortions. But these are the issues that won in Australia. And if we look at today's youth, we can see that young people today are overwhelmingly supportive of progressive ideals. Overwhelmingly. It's very different. In the 1980s, I remember the young people were more conservative than the voting public at large. Not anymore. The young people today hate George Bush. They at least hate his policies. They want to see more environmentalism. They want to see more progressive ideas. They want to see more health care. And the interesting thing is that Kevin Rudd, the winner of the Australian election, was largely focused on workers' rights, on unions. America hasn't had an election where people are focused on unions, I don't know, since what, the 20s? But what did he focus on? The fact that in the conservative government, they were taking away workers' rights. What's going on in America today? Where are workers' pensions? Whether by the corporations, they're gone, and now they're trying to take away Social Security too. Health care. We know that's provided by employers. It's not enough. Many people are uninsured, and they want to deny it from the government too. Workers' rights. Workers' rights. Can you believe it? I think it's sad that we have some in the Democratic Party who are running away from the unions. Don't run away from the unions. Most Americans are still pulling that 9-to-5 job. They need workers' rights. And if they can do it in Australia, we can do it here. Folks, if you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. When we come back, I want to talk about prospects more for elections in America in 2008. Right back after this.
This is the Head-On Radio Network, The Horn.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Bush just pulled the knee strings on his puppet in Iraq, and Nouri al-Maliki did the jig. The prime minister signed on to a deal laying the groundwork for the long-term presence of U.S. troops there. Permanent military bases, anyone? To inaugurate the pact, U.S. troops in Baghdad killed three women on a bus that was approaching a U.S. roadblock. Part of the enduring relationship that Bush and Maliki laid out in this pact has nothing to do with the presence of U.S. troops, but with the profits of U.S. corporations. The deal would give preferential treatment for American investments, AP reports, adding nonchalantly that this could provide a huge windfall if Iraq can achieve enough stability to exploit its vast oil resources. There's that dirty three-letter word again, oil, which this war was never supposed to be about, but always, in part, was. Oil and profits are two big reasons why Bush will keep probably more than 100,000 U.S. troops in Iraq for the foreseeable future. Those are not legitimate reasons, however, to ask our soldiers to die for, and almost 4,000 of them have done so already. But at least it's out in the open now. The crassness, that is. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
It wasn't exactly planes, trains, and automobiles on Head On with Bob Kincaid.
This is what the Bush administration Justice Department didn't want you to see back in 2001. They took out and they huffed the marker a little bit, and then they went, oh, cool. And they wiped out the name where it says, the plane was chartered either by the Saudi Arabian royalty family or Osama bin Laden. Somebody's got to call up and say, good afternoon. Thank you for calling Ryan International Flights. How may I help you?
Hello. This is Osama bin Laden, and I would like to rent a Boeing 727. Do you have one handy?
Oh, just a moment. Let me check. It's a Mr. bin Laden wants to know if we got a 727. Do we, Harry, do we have a 727?
Yeah, we got a 727 just sitting there on the lot. Going cheap.
There's nothing here. Nothing to look at. Keep moving. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The 6'7" Arab with the portable dialysis machine and the white robes.
Somebody's trying.
Head On with Bob Kincaid, weeknights, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern, only on the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. It is the weekend review. There is a lot to talk about, and we'll get back to the presidential race in a minute, but I want to briefly talk about the congressional races in 08. Yes, it's not too soon to talk about that. The 06 Congress is already about half done. It's got one half to go, and it's looking like prospects for 08 are even better. So if it annoys you that you think Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are too weak-kneed, that they're not doing all they were elected to do, they are probably going to get some ammunition. I got to tell you, as I have before, that the way the world works in Washington is not Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid snapping their fingers. They got a whole host of Democrats to get in line. And right now, the margins are extremely thin. They've got 51-49 in the Senate. That 51 includes Joe Lieberman, who is not always on the Democratic side. They've got a small margin in the House. But in the Senate, we are headed for, and I don't want to jinx it, but possibly a tremendous victory. Trent Lott, yes, good old praise segregationist Strom Thurmond, Trent Lott, number two in the Republican Party. You know, you got to put those racists really high up in the Republican Party so all the poor white trash takes notice. But Trent Lott is getting out. He's retiring. Largely, the analysts say, because he actually had a reputation for keeping his word. And even though he was intensely partisan, he could make a deal with the Democrats and keep it. Can't have people like that in the Republican Party anymore. Trent Lott is going, and there's a whole host of people going. Pete Domenici in New Mexico is going, and Udall is almost certain to win that seat. In my home state of Virginia, we're going to see John Warner retire, and Democrat Mark Warner will almost certainly win and take his place. It's happening all across the country. In Colorado, we've got a good chance. And yes, now even in the House, in all these purple states, Colorado, New Mexico, Ohio, Arizona, even in Illinois, where Denny Hastert, former Speaker of the House, is retiring, there are good chances for the Democratic Party. And what the numbers does is it increases their strength. Let's face it, if you want Harry Reid or Nancy Pelosi to do more, they can do a lot more with greater numbers. And it's exciting. It's exciting because, you know, you need 60 to do a filibuster. And if we, well, actually, to stop a filibuster, you need 40 to do a filibuster. I'm not saying we can get 60 seats, but we could get 55, 56, and then pick off a few Republicans. We really could make a huge difference. And instead of doing the kind of congressional work that I did, the congressional work that I did, which was trying to stop bad things from happening, we can actually do some good things for this country, for worker rights, for health care, for environmentalism, stop global warming, end our dependency on foreign oil, bring our troops home. These are all things we can do. And the Democrats, shockingly, have even an advantage in money because the people are angry. They want the Democrats to take power over the Republicans. But it's not just that. You know how it is in Washington. The lobbyists are betting on the winning people. And everyone bets the Democrats are going to win, so they have a lot more money. And Trent Lott will do his best to cash in on it. In fact, one of the reasons why he's likely to retire prior to the Christmas holiday break in December is because if he does that, then he can start lobbying fresh in 09. Whereas if he, let's see here, if he doesn't do so, he'll be eligible in, I think it's 11. I have to check that for you. The point is he can lobby sooner if he gets out now, and of course, making money is very much what the Republicans are about. I got to get you that. In 11 o'clock, I'll get you the answer on the lobbying because I want to give you the information. But it is exciting for the Democrats in Congress, and it's also exciting the presidential race. One of the things I find interesting, really, is on the Republican side, what's going on with Mitt Romney. Because here you have a case of blatant religious prejudice that is disqualifying Mitt Romney, not from the Democrats, but from the Republicans. You know, for all the criticisms I've heard, and I've heard a lot of criticisms about Harry Reid on the Democratic side, I've heard all kinds of things. He's weak-kneed on Iraq, he gives in to corporate interests, all kinds of things, and many of those criticisms, most of them, are justified. I have never heard one Democrat, one liberal, one progressive condemn Harry Reid for being Mormon. In fact, I don't think many Democrats realize that the leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate happens to be Mormon. Why not? Well, because Harry Reid doesn't make his Mormon religion part of his identity. I'm sure he is Mormon. It's a fact. But he doesn't run on it. He doesn't claim that's a reason to vote for him. I don't know how much money he raises from the Mormon community, but he's certainly nothing like Mitt Romney, who gets most of his donations from Utah. Here's the interesting thing about Mitt Romney. Republicans, And remember, 40% or more of the Republican Party is controlled by Christian fundamentalists, by people who take the Bible literally, people who don't believe in evolution, believe the earth was created in 6 days, people who hate modern-day science. They're the same people who say that a vote for Romney is a vote for Satan. And yes, that's an exact quote from a televangelist. A vote for Romney is a vote for Satan. Should we be concerned about this religious prejudice? Well, in one sense, we should, right? I mean, John F. Kennedy famously said, yeah, I'm Catholic, but you should vote for me because of my stance on the issues. You should ignore the fact that I'm Catholic. It's unrelated to what I would do in office. Look at my stance on the issues. Vote or don't vote for me based on that. Don't let the fact that I'm Catholic bother you. And, of course, John F. Kennedy won a famously narrow election. So, if Mitt Romney were to say, hey, don't worry about the fact that I'm Mormon, you know, just because I believe that Jesus will come back to the Americas as well as to Jerusalem, because America is you know, the land of the lost tribes of Israel and all that kind of stuff, that's irrelevant to what I would do as policy. He could say that. And then at that point, I would come to his defense if anyone were to attack him based on his religion. But he hasn't said that. He hasn't had a John F. Kennedy moment. He has never said once that my religion is unrelated to what I will do in office. Just vote for me while I stand on the issues. To the contrary, he has said religion does infuse what I stand for. In fact, he's tried to pretend, wrongly, that Mormonism is the same thing as evangelical Protestantism. It is not. But he plays that game because he knows on which side his bread is buttered. He knows who controls the Republican Party, and he's trying to persuade them to vote for him. He could never say, because the Republican Party, the party of theology, our own Al-Qaeda-like Taliban party run by religious fundamentalists, that's how I feel about them sometimes, they're fundamentalists. These fundamentalists control the party. So Romney can't say my religion is irrelevant, because to him it's not. He will tell you, why doesn't he think gay people should have equal rights? Because of his religion. Why doesn't he think that women should be able to control their own reproductive capacity? Because of his religion. It's one thing if he tried to defend his antithesis toward gay rights by relying on something else, if he just said, you know, gay people make me uncomfortable, or I hate them, or they smell, or whatever people use to justify racism or anything else. But he doesn't. He relies on his religion. And because he relies on his religion, and I hope you followed me here, because Mitt Romney relies on his religion, because his policies are dictated by his religion, because he refuses to separate his private religious beliefs from his public conduct, therefore, Mitt Romney's religion is relevant. The fact that he's Mormon is relevant. For all the reasons that Harry Reid's Mormonism is not relevant, Mitt Romney's Mormonism is, because it infuses his policy. It is as relevant as Islamic fundamentalism is to Al-Qaeda. It is as relevant as Christian fundamentalism is to Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson. All Romney has to do is distance himself and say, look, I have private beliefs. We all have strange beliefs about the end of times. It doesn't affect what I will do as president, and I want you to vote based on my policies. And he says that, and I will immediately come to his defense for anyone that says, I can't vote for Mitt Romney because he's Mormon. That's as wrong as I can't vote for someone because they're an atheist, and the majority of Americans have said that. But because he infuses his policies with his religion, is it fair game to attack him because of his Mormonism? You betcha. You bet it is. And I want you to think about that when Mitt Romney may well lose the election because of his religion. Why that would be fair, whereas attacking John F. Kennedy for his religion would not be fair. I still got more to cover, folks. I didn't finish it all today. That's okay. I'm going to be on 11 o'clock talking with John Fox about the Australian election, talking with Bob Kincaid. One of the topics I want to raise in there is this whole topic of illegal aliens getting driver's licenses, getting health care. And I want to see what they think about my view that it is fair to judge Mitt Romney based on his religion. So you can tune into that at 11 o'clock. I hope you will join us for that. Until then, I give you Bob Kincaid. I know he's got a terrific story about a bear named Muhammad. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
This is the Quality News Network. In a joint statement read by President Bush, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas agreed to start discussions on the key subjects of the Mideast conflict. Today's peace summit in Annapolis, Maryland is the first peace talk between the two parties in 7 years. In the past 48 hours, Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 7 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israelis say the men all belong to Hamas. In Hebron, in the West Bank, a protest against the Annapolis peace talks prompted clashes between those loyal to Palestinian President Abbas and Islamists who call him a traitor. One demonstrator was shot and killed during the skirmishes. Stocks bounced back today on news that Citigroup got a cash infusion of $7 billion from the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority. The Dow was up over 200 points today. We'll have the numbers coming up in our business segment. This holiday season may be bleak for many Americans who will lose their homes to foreclosure. An estimated 1.4 million U.S. families will be forced into foreclosure. According to the consultant firm Global Insight, escalating failed mortgage payments will knock approximately $676 billion from home